for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. More than 1,600 American soldiers have lost limbs in Iraq or Afghanistan, mainly due to bombs like the ones that injured hundreds of people in Boston last month. Over the last 10 years, research on treating troops with amputated limbs have led to scientific advances in robotic arms and legs that are changing people's lives. Here with me in the studio to talk about bionic limbs, Michael McLaughlin of Johns Hopkins University, John Matheny, an arm amputee patient, Peggy Chenoweth, an advocate with the Amputee Coalition, and Mike Corcoran, an artificial limb expert who works with veterans. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And to let you know, this hour of the Diane Rehm Show is also being video streamed so you can see these artificial limbs at work yourselves. Good morning to all of you and welcome.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. Michael McLaughlin, if I could start with you. Tell me about this robotic arm. I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it's actually controlled by the mind.
That's correct. So the goal here was to create a prosthetic that could be controlled very naturally. And so we made an arm that's able to do virtually everything that your natural arm can do. And the challenge then is, how do I control that in a way that's very natural? So we do very complex things. We don't really think about them. And so what we've developed is a way of interfacing with the brain, whether that be connecting to the nerves that remain after an amputation, or actually doing an implant in the brain with small electrodes that can pick up signals for somebody that, say, has a spinal cord injury. They can't no longer use their arms because the information doesn't get there anymore.
How does that differ from the kind of deep brain stimulation activity that doctors are implanting for, say, Parkinson's patients?
Okay, so there's a couple of differences. One is we're working in a different area of the brain.
Of course. We
work in the what's known as the cortex. So these are the areas of the brain closest to the surface of the skull that's associated with our higher level thought. And we also are just listening. So to move the arm, we're just listening to what the brain is doing, as opposed to deep brain stimulation, which is actually stimulating the brain.
What do you mean listening to what the brain is doing?
Sure. So every time you think about moving your arm, there's areas of your brain that are associated with that motion, and you basically get little electrical impulses with the nerves in that area, so that we can put an electrode near those nerves, or actually sets of electrodes near those nerves, so that every time one of those nerves fires one of those little electrical impulses, we can hear it.
So how long did it take to develop this robotic arm?
Well, we've been working on this for 7 years now.
7 years.
7 years.
And I gather it has some 100 sensors.
Yeah, so that's the other half of the challenge here. So we take sensors that are on, say, the fingertips, and when the arm touches an object, we can actually then make measurements, which then we try to then feed back to the wearer so that you actually get some sense of touch.
I see. All right. And that was the voice of Michael McLaughlin. He's an engineer and the principal investigator at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. And now turning to you, Johnny Matheny, I gather you had your arm amputated because of cancer. Tell us what happened.
Well, I had a knot that was growing up on my forearm, right close to my wrist. And it was not bothering me, but my wife told me I need to have it looked at. And just as soon as they cut it open to check out what it was a fast-spreadable cancer. And it ended up being fibrosarcoma. And it's a muscle that grows on, cancer that grows on the muscle. And by doing this, once they opened it, it started spreading up. Well, they ended up doing 5 surgeries and 39 radiation treatments trying to cut it out and burn it out.
Wow.
And it didn't slow it down. It just kept progressing up my arm. So the only final thing they had to do was try to take the arm above where the last known place the cancer had been in hopes of getting it so it wouldn't get to my stump. I mean, to my, yeah, my stump, my
your
body.
Your stomach, your intestines.
Yes, once I got it in there, they said it would. You'd have probably 6 months.
So they said if we take your arm at which joint?
Well, they asked me, they said, you know, what do you feel would be comfortable to you? I said, I don't care, you can take it off at the shoulder if you have to. I just want it above the cancer. And so they did their study, and this is where they found it, that it would be best to take it just above the elbow.
Just above the elbow. So now this robotic arm allows you to do what? And you can hold it up so that those who are seeing the program on video streaming at drshow.org can actually see it. What can you do with that arm?
With this arm, you're able to do just about anything you can do with your regular hand, wrist, or elbow.
Can you move your fingers? And you can move those fingers by...
just thinking about it.
Thinking about it.
It's the old-style prosthetics. They would tap into your bicep and tricep muscles only. And as you work those, that would tell the arm what to do. But now that they've done the targeted muscle reinnervation surgery that Dr. Albert Chi at Johns Hopkins has taken over in this area, that it taps in, they take muscles that normally would go down your hand and they would tap it in different places on your muscles in the upper arm. And each time that your brain wants to do something like open hand, well, you know, it's a minute electrical impulse that comes down and it'll wiggle that muscle. Well, then the sensor within the pad itself then tells the computer, this is what I want to do. And therefore that the hand then operates that way. And it's no different than, you know, just about like this. The more you use it, the more fluent you're going to get. And it grows with you.
And how long did it take you to adjust to that?
It comes gradual. You can't do everything at once because, like with myself, it's been 3 years since I lost it, my arm, before we started doing this. And what it needed to do was retrain the brain that now you can send signals down, it's actually going to work. And through visual tells the brain, this is moving, you start opening pathways more and more and more. In the meantime, I took home a computer that has a virtual arm on it. And it's based on the same principle as this arm here, so that I could work with at home. This way you can train your muscles, you know, fine-tune them down to the point, because when you first start, you may have a group of 3 muscles working to try to do the same thing, and it gets confused, and, it doesn't work properly. Then as you fine-tune down to the final muscle that you need, then you should get more fluent and more open and close with it.
Now, are the muscles in your upper arm working?
They work to a degree. In some aspects, you know, you're just thinking, well, it just automatically jiggles, sensor takes it, and goes on with it.
So how do you feel about all this?
Oh, I love it. I've been threatened APL lab, I was going to take this thing home with me every time I go down there and work with it.
Well, it certainly looks as though it moves well. Could you drive with it?
Yes, eventually, as you get more fluent with it, you can actually drive with it.
Can you cook with it?
Oh, now, this is something that you're talking of my way. Because I am a cook, and yes, we've already tried this on different aspects of cooking, and it works out very well.
Put your arm up again so that people can see it and see it move and see those fingers flex. It's just remarkable. I congratulate you.
Thank you.
And have you tried catching a ball?
No, I haven't tried catching a ball yet. But we had a side effect that come on when they did the TMR surgery. In this case, it was a good side effect. I got the sensation on my pointer finger and my pinky finger. So that anytime, like, you put something in my hand, like a softball, I could tell you it's a softball or a hardball. Whenever you go to reach and shake somebody's hand, because most of the time, that's the first thing they want to do, shake my hand. They want to see if you can control it or if you're going to crush their hand or what. And so I reach out, and the sensation I can feel just about when to quit and shake their hand and give them a good shake, but not being too soft.
And, of course, when you came in this morning, because it's your left arm that has been amputated, I put out my right hand to shake your right hand. But I promise you, before you leave, I'll shake your left hand.
Okay.
We'll take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll talk with our other guests, Peggy Chenoweth and Mike Corcoran. Stay with us. Welcome back. I have four wonderful guests this morning. Michael McLaughlin is an engineer and principal investigator at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. Johnny Matheny had his arm amputated because of cancer in 2008. He is certainly helping researchers at Johns Hopkins University develop a robotic arm, and as you have seen, he uses that quite effectively. And now to Mike Corcoran. He's co-founder of the Medical Center Orthotics and Prosthetics. That's a Maryland-based company that works with injured veterans at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. And Peggy Chenoweth, she's an advocate with the Amputee Coalition, a national organization. She blogs about being a parent of an amputee on amputeemommy.com. And Mike Corcoran, tell us about what you do and how artificial legs and feet have changed in the last few years.
Well, I work primarily at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. We provide lower extremity prosthetics for injured service members. And over the past 8 years, technology has come forward in great leaps and bounds from the first microprocessor knee, or the only one, 8-9 years ago, to now we have multiple microprocessor knees and ankles, and now powered prosthetics, which is motorized knee joints and ankle joints that propel the user.
Now, how do they work differently from, say, an individual who has to have a knee, an ordinary knee replacement? How does that prosthetic knee work differently?
Well, so the amputees that we deal with are combat injured and typically blast injuries, similar to those in Boston. And so when an amputee loses two joints, say an ankle and a knee, the knee joint becomes very important for stability and also efficiency in walking. The big difference in lower extremity prosthetics currently to upper extremity prosthetics that, say, Mike and the people at Johns Hopkins are developing is that they use user intent or the user thought control, correct, yes. Currently, lower extremity prosthetics, all the sensors are actually on board the device.
Uh-huh.
So they're all built into, say, the knee joint or the ankle joint.
So how do they work?
There's like accelerometers, gyroscopes, and load sensors.
Yeah, but you got to explain to me what
okay,
that
means. Okay, so basically an accelerometer is something that measures the velocity of the legs moving forward. The gyroscope measures the angle or of the joint itself.
Okay.
And the load sensor is how much weight's been put on the joint.
Okay.
And what that does is a computer, onboard computer, is programmed to let the knee perform certain things if all these criteria is met. And so, essentially, it's not thought-controlled. You teach the user, the patient, how to trigger the device. And sounds complicated, but it's so well designed. It's actually with powered knees, we just tell our patients just to get up and walk.
So each patient then would have to have this computer calibrated to his or her pace of walking, the weight, the strength, and so on.
Correct. Yes. As a prosthetist, we fabricate the devices too, but we also program the knees or the ankles to the individual user. However, technology and the manufacturers of these components have made it fairly simple to program. So the devices are quite intuitive to the user.
So the user, him or herself, could calibrate the device or must it be calibrated by a professional?
Yeah, the process calibrates. Now, there are some devices that use artificial intelligence that you tell the amputee to walk, and then the device learns the gait of the amputee, and then it's kind of locked into that knee joint.
Mike Corcoran, he's co-founder of Medical Center Orthotics and Prosthetics. That's a Maryland-based company working with injured veterans at Walter Reed National Military Center. And now to you, Peggy Chenoweth, talk about how you became part of this community.
I was injured in 1998. I was at a conference right out of college, my dream job, and a computer fell on top of my foot and crushed the bones and the nerves on the top of my foot. And we tried for 5 years to try to save my foot. And eventually I opted to amputate so that I could get rid of the pain in crutches.
So you had lots of pain in this foot after the computer fell on you.
Correct. We tried for over 20 surgeries in that 5 years to try to save the limb. And it finally, when I was first injured, I wanted to save it at all costs. And after 5 years, I literally was in front of a judge begging to have my foot amputated so I could move on with my life.
So where exactly was the foot amputated?
I am below knee, so I have about 5 or 6 inches below my knee.
And then what?
So this was 10 years ago, and I was fit with a prosthetic and went about living my life and thought, okay, I'm walking. And then one day my prosthetist called me into the office and said, I think we can do better. I want you to try this new bionic ankle. And I tried it and everything changed. I realized that all of the little things that I was kind of taken as in accepting that I'm an amputee, so my back's going to hurt. I'm an amputee, so my gait's going to be limited. That all of a sudden that was corrected by this device, and it just opened up a whole new world for me.
May I see?
I'm not wearing it today. I'm not. I'm wearing a different foot today.
A different foot today?
Yes.
Why?
I chose to not wear the bionic foot today because, we were taking the metro in, and I was worried if I was going to have to run between trains. You can't really run in a bionic foot.
I see.
So that's one of the limitations. Although they're great devices for everyday walking, that they're not really high-impact devices. So if I'm worried that I'm going to be running or jogging or kicking a ball or getting dirty, I have to wear a different foot.
I see. And what does this foot allow you to do?
The one that I'm wearing now?
Yes.
The one that I'm wearing now is a basic do-everything foot. Last night I was in the stream catching tadpoles with my little boy wearing it, and today I'm on the radio show. So you can kind of live your whole life with it. It doesn't have the features that the bionic foot offers. So my gait is different when I wear this foot. I'm more cognizant of walking than I am with my bionic foot. I'm thinking a little bit more about the steps and where I'm walking, when I'm wearing the computerized foot, I can just kind of put it on and walk.
And tell me why you decided to establish the blog AmputeeMommy.com.
When I was pregnant with my little boy, I tried to find information on how pregnancy was going to be impacted by my amputation and prosthetic, and I could find nothing. And I just decided that there was no use reinventing the wheel. And once I figured it out, I was going to put it out there and see if I could help other parents.
And
that's how it started. And I've been blogging now for 5 years. People have seen my little boy grow up. And I talk about everyday issues. I write about prosthetic issues. I write about concerns within the community and how my amputation and prosthetic impacts not just me, but the family, because it's not just the amputee that's affected by this. It's everybody around them.
And, of course, so many veterans coming home and needing these kinds of amputations, Mike.
Yes. well, actually, there's 1,800 amputees since the start of, since 9/11.
And there are 500 every day in this country.
Every day
in this country, there are 500 amputations in this country alone.
And that has nothing to do with Iraq, Afghanistan.
Right. I think the visibility of amputees has become more visible because of our service members. And they survived life-threatening injuries. So it's not a stigma, being an amputee. I don't see it as a stigma. So, and most of these young guys and gals are proud to wear their prosthesis, and they don't want it covered, and they want to showcase the technology that's enabling them to live their lives.
I detect that lovely Irish.
Yeah, I'm from Dublin.
I thought so. Yeah. I thought so. And how long have you been here?
I've been here 20 years.
And why did you initially get into this work?
I came over here to train for the Olympics. And I kind of got into prosthetics because Olympic athletes don't make any money. And so I did some technical work for a prosthetic prosthetist in Virginia. And she asked me if I'd like to, learn this field. And so I said, sure. And then after my sporting days were over, I went to Northwestern University in Chicago for prosthetics and orthotics.
I see. All of this costs a lot of money. Michael, how much?
Well, we've spent, this has mostly been supported by the Department of Defense, and it represents an investment by the the government over $100 million in developing this
technology. $100 million. And Johnny Matheny, what do you think this arm of yours would cost?
Well, right now I'm not sure, but one thing I am sure of, it cost me an arm.
It cost you an arm.
And, I mean, it's to see this come about, I mean, this is nice, especially with the servicemen coming back. I got into this because I don't like negatives. When I lost my arm, it was a negative. I wanted something positive to come out of this. So I told my prosthetist that I want to do something, some studies or whatever. I said, you know, I'm an old fart. It ain't going to hurt me if it fails, that if you cut half my arm off or cut the rest of it off. I'd rather me than the young guys coming back.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But cost in dollars for this prosthetic arm, Michael?
Well, this is still in the research stage.
Right.
And so one of our challenges is really looking at how we move to a commercially available version of the arm. And one of the challenges that we face is, although there are 500 amputations a day in this country, a very small percentage of them are upper extremity. Most are lower. Okay.
And how did they occur for the most part?
For most of lower extremity amputations, it's frequently due to cardiovascular issues, your diabetes or other circulatory issues. And so we have something that is very complex, and we have very small numbers of potential users of it. So the challenge then is, you know, how do you develop a sustainable business model that makes it, that supports the long-term usage of the technology?
But surely an arm like this would cost what?
We don't really know, but it's certainly going to be more expensive than what's currently available.
Like $100,000?
We expect to get it less than that.
You will hope to.
Yeah, maybe half that. So we're looking at options, for example, staff working with not-for-profits to enable people to get the technology.
Good. All right. We're going to open the phones, take our first call from Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I just want to say thanks for taking my call. I had a quick question regarding the relative strength of these the prosthetics and versus the normal strength of the hand, and how they relate, how much you can lift versus how much you can lift before the arm falls off the stub versus how strong the grip is, etc.
Johnny Matheny.
Well, with the strength of the arm, it has the same capabilities as your normal hand. You can be just as soft as you want to be, crush cans. It can lift. The one that I'm wearing right now is like a military-style arm, and it's supposed to be able to pick up 200 pounds.
200 pounds?
Correct.
And you could, of course, with your other arm, lift that much.
Right.
If you needed to.
Yeah, this one was built so if they were in the field and they were bunkered down and they need to move quick, the machine gun that sits on the ground that has the stand and everything, they'll be able to reach down with a prosthetic, pick it up, and walk off with it. Never slow down.
I would surely hope that someone with a prosthesis of this sort would not be going back into battle.
Well, you know, we have soldiers that have gone back to the field with lower extremity prosthetics.
Really?
So, absolutely. I would someday would like to see our military members be able to go back to service if that's what they would like to do.
Mike Corcoran?
Yeah, we've had a number of lower extremity amputees return to active duty and some in combat. There's also been some upper extremity amputees that have returned, transradial amputees or below elbow amputees. It's not advertised. They're professionals. This is what they're trained to do, and they suffer these injuries. They want to regain the ability to do what they're trained to do.
Peggy Chenoweth, are you limited in any way by your prosthetic foot?
I don't think that I'm limited by my amputation. I am limited by activities. I have a foot for different purposes, but there's not really one foot that's great for absolutely everything yet. So I have to plan ahead, and I'm not real good at that all the time.
And you did plan ahead.
I did plan ahead today.
Yes.
But, you know, if we're going to the park, I have to really make sure that I have the correct leg with me. If we're going to go on vacation, I have a bag full of legs that I have to pack.
A bag full of legs.
So I do. But I'm lucky because I can get a bag full of legs. There are a lot of amputees in this country who can't get one.
I have to tell you a terrible experience I had. I was flying to Pittsburgh. I picked up my suitcase off the motorized lane, got to my hotel, opened my suitcase, and there was a prosthetic leg. I had picked up the wrong suitcase. And of course, that person needed her suitcase. Short break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The U.S. Poet Laureate explores the links between race and memory in her own life and in American history. Natasha Trethewey on making poetry accessible. The Diane Rehm Show next hour.
Got lots of callers waiting. We'll go first to Layton, Utah. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Diane, and thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I lost my hand in 1964.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, it's neither here nor there, but thank you. And I've watched the progress of hands coming along, and I've seen that they've made incredible progress over the years, but they seem to be weak. They seem to be vulnerable. And I wonder if anything is solved yet. Mine is fiberglass, and I've been through five of them now that have broken. And I wear a hook, but I don't go with the other ones because they're even more vulnerable.
What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, so one of our challenges in building this arm was to make a limb that would be more robust. And so we've actually used this one quite a bit. Johnny's put it through its paces. We've put a lot of effort into making it function like a human hand. You're still not going to be able to do things like, for example, you can't immerse that in water. It won't.
Interesting.
Wouldn't like that.
Interesting. Why not? What would happen?
Yeah, it's just not sealed up
Right.
As well as it would need to be.
Okay.
But we can put a covering over the arm.
What kind of time frame do you believe will transpire before this is available to the general public?
Yeah. So the challenge right now is really just designing this really for commercial use. So I think we could be there in a couple of years.
I see. And Mike Corcoran, what about George's concern that the hook he is wearing seems to have more strength than perhaps what is available in a prosthetic hand?
Right. Well, the hook has less moving parts.
Of course.
So and it tends to be a lot of amputees say that it's most versatile because they can actually see what they're going to pick up. Sometimes a hand, when you go to pick up an object and you can't see through the hand and you don't have sensory feedback, it's hard to see where the hand is in relation to what you're trying to grasp. So typically, again, when manufacturers develop hands, they want to have as much motion in the hand as possible. And then, so that's more moving parts, and it's difficult to make robust, a hand with many joints robust. See, our own hands that we have cells that replenish. If we injure ourselves, we heal ourselves. But with a prosthetic hand, it doesn't do that.
Well, are you saying that as far as strength is concerned, that George is better off with a hook as opposed to a prosthetic hand?
No, I'm saying George and every amputee needs to keep pushing for better technology, make their prosthesis, talk to wonderful institutions like Johns Hopkins to develop stronger, more mobile joints, better artificial hands, because the end user is the amputee. And we all here, apart from Johnny, are trying to develop it. But if there's no one pressing us to, continue this development, then we won't see any advancements.
George, you've got to do your part.
May I make a suggestion then?
Certainly.
There's a physicist from Arizona. His name is Patrick Flanagan. He developed something called a neurophone back in the late 50s. Gone through 16 generations of it now, and it actually reads thoughts by compressing square waves. Now, he was teaching dolphins to put submarine mines underneath Soviet submarines back in the 80s, and they were learning to do that by the technology that he had. It was a 9-year fight for him to get that out of the hands of the Navy and get it patented.
All right. Have you heard anything about that, Michael?
No, I'm not familiar with that particular set of work.
Well, I urge you, George, to get on this issue and push your own medical center to be developing something a little more sophisticated and user-friendly, perhaps, than that hook. Good morning, Tom, in San Antonio, Texas. You're on the air.
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
The thing that I wanted to observe was that in the last year, I have been able to take advantage of microprocessors in both my knees and my feet. I am over 60 and typically in a category that the people who make decisions as to who these things are available to would decide he won't benefit from it, he's too old. But what happened to me was, by having these new knees and feet that I now have...
Oh dear, what happened? Did we lose you? All right, well, I'm sure you were shaking your head, Mike Corcoran.
Yeah, I think that... the people that make decisions as regards funding, CMS, Medicare, and insurance companies, will look at these big ticket items and say, "Oh, that's awfully expensive, and he's not going to. He doesn't need this. He could get by with something more basic." Well, what we've seen is, if you provide basic feet and knees that are inadequate, you're going to basically condemn that amputee to a sedentary lifestyle, and that's going to lead to more costs for healthcare because they're going to have a lot more issues cardiovascularly, greater hospitalization. Mobility is vitally important for humans. We have two legs. We stand. We walk. So a prosthesis that may seem expensive that allows the amputee to be more mobile is actually healthier. It's a healthier lifestyle.
All right. Here's an email from Jeff in Baltimore. What about people who were born without limbs and not able to develop that portion of the brain that controls movements of those limbs? Would they be able to utilize such mechanical limbs?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's something that we've had an opportunity to do some very limited work with congenital amputees, and we have found that we've been able to give them the ability to control the limb. It's not, you know, it's not natural for them because they've never done it before, but they are able to do it, and so there's more of a learning curve involved in it. But we think that this would work for congenital amputees also.
And here's another question from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Hi there, Richard.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your guests whether any of this technology might have some application in the future for those of us who are polio survivors from the epidemics of the 40s and 50s.
Wow.
I've been walking on crutches for now almost 60 years and leg braces. And, you know, the people like me, we have the limbs, we have the joints, we have the muscles. What we don't have is the original wire that ran from the brain to the muscle telling it to contract. And, you know, obviously we're all getting older at a rapid clip, and I just hope that we're not a forgotten generation and that maybe someday in the not-too-distant future some of this technology may help us do things that many of us haven't done since our early childhood.
Mike Corcoran.
Well, actually, the company that developed the powered ankle, iWalk, are developing it's a motor that generates the power for that ankle. They're using applications on orthotics or orthoses, which this collar probably wears, that would replace a motor. Essentially, is a muscle. So there is development taking place for powered orthoses, which would enable post-polio sufferers to be more mobile.
Michael McLaughlin.
Yeah, well, we're focused on upper extremity use.
I see.
But for patients that, due to a spinal cord injury or other neurodegenerative condition, can't use their natural limbs, what this potentially provides is a way for them to use a prosthetic limb in order to interact with their environment and pick things up and do all the activities of daily life.
Johnny Matheny, is there something further that you wish to learn to do with this arm that you have not yet learned?
Well, there's a lot of possibilities. Like I say, there's a lot of sensors that you can put on it. You can tell when you brush up against something. You can tell when something's cold or something's hot. All these different things. Sensors that, you know, that goes in the fingers. You know how much pressure you're actually putting on something, whether you're barely touching something, or you know you got enough grip on yourself to crush a can, just like snap.
Could you hold a pencil?
Yes.
And write with it?
Yes, with this type of hand, you're able to be able to do that, and it has different grasp that you can do, which I have not programmed in right now.
Okay. So if I were to hand you this pen right now, could you grasp it?
Not at this time.
Okay.
What we got to do each day is we're going to figure out what we're going to be doing today. And we program in to the computer, we'll possibly make these moves today. So then as we go through that, we can do that. Now, coming here to the show, you know, I wasn't ready to start grasping pens, or we would have incorporated that in. But the computer, what you do is is you do the moves, and the computer tells the hand or the wrist, this is what I want to do.
And you keep adding, yes. I gather, movements.
Correct.
That you are anticipating and would like to do. And then is there a permanent memory of what you've incorporated?
At this time, no. But
you have to do it all over again.
Each morning. Yes. But there, we've got the smartest techs at APL Lab. They'll soon have that problem licked.
So it's like you, Peggy, sort of figuring out each day.
It takes a lot of planning to be an amputee.
A lot of planning.
So and I think what you're seeing is that the we're on the verge of some great technology, but I don't think it's really there yet for everyday functional life. I don't think the technology is there, especially in the upper extremity, somewhat in the lower extremity. It's certainly not available to every amputee.
But it has sure come a long way.
If you're going to be an amputee, this is the best time in history to be one.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Diane. I'm glad I got through to you in time because I know it's short. I'm just wondering why this has never been addressed before. Apparently, a British engineer produced some kind of gadget that prevented the signal of these IEDs from going off. And the Pentagon, being bloody-minded as they are, they didn't want to use the gadget because it was a British invention and they didn't think of it first. But it would have prevented a lot of unnecessary amputees and that.
I think you've got the wrong audience to address the military and IEDs, Tom. The fact of the matter is when they go off and they do take limbs, it's pretty awful. Here's an email from Brian in Detroit, Michigan, wanting to ask you, Johnny Matheny, whether you've had phantom limb pain before getting the prosthetic, and has the prosthetic alleviated that phantom pain?
Oh, yes. Phantom pains, I'm very well aware of it. My hand would just throb. I can tell you exactly how my hand was being at that time, whether it be a fist like this or like that or like this.
After the amputation.
Now, once we got into the prosthetics, where the brain is starting to see things move, it's forgetting about the pains and going more
to pain.
It's going more into movement. That's what it's wanting. That's what it's searching for. And when you get your arm amputated, what it is, when they cut the nerve endings, it scars over. And that's what causes the phantom pain.
How about you, Peggy? Did you experience phantom pain?
I have phantom sensations at times. When the weather is really changing, I'll have pain. If I switch sockets, I'll feel it. But I don't have a lot of issues like other amputees
do. All right. And finally, to Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Robert.
Hi, guys. I have kind of a two-part question, I suppose, but I'll keep it brief, I promise. The first part is that I think it kind of goes without saying that we're in the digital age, and I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on whether or not the technology for robotics and autonomous machines that we're trying to make more and more like humans, is that technology perhaps interchangeable with that of prosthetics technology?
Mike Corcoran.
Yeah, I think that actually the motor that drives the powered knee is the same motor that came off the Mars rover that propels that device in Mars. So there is collaboration between robotics and prosthetics. I think there's...
Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the technology that we've developed here we're using on robotic systems for dealing with IEDs so that ultimately we'd like to send the robot out to deal with an IED so that the robot gets injured as opposed to a human.
And finally, a lot of people are wondering about cost, whether insurance covers any of this, Michael?
Insurance covers most lower extremity advanced prosthetics. Once Medicare recognizes that it is a viable device, they issue it with a code, and then private payers tend to adopt that same policy.
Oh, I see. And what about the development of something as sophisticated as this, yeah. Michael?
So the cost reimbursement is a significant issue and hindrance to upper extremity prosthetics. And so we're looking at options for dealing with some private entities, non-profit foundations that would essentially fill in that gap so that somebody who needs a prosthetic can get it.
Well, I congratulate you all on your efforts, your endeavors, and I know that this work is going to help thousands, millions of people. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Michael McLaughlin, Johnny Matheny, Peggy Chenoweth, and Mike Corcoran. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Reed.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.